For the past month or so, we have been looking at different questions that are obstacles for people, causing them, making it hard for them to believe Christianity. We're looking at obstacles to the Christian faith. And we're trying to take these obstacles seriously and have real discourse, not just kind of throw around snarky comments, but honestly, allow you to express your disbelief and have a dialogue about it. And today we're talking about what I think, what John Stott and many others think is the biggest obstacle for most believers, and that is, or for most people, and that is the problem of suffering. It's something that's ubiquitous. It's everywhere, and it hurts. And we want to cry out, God, if you're there, if you love us, if you're a good God, if you're a powerful God, why is there so much suffering in the world? We're like Charles Templeton. Charles Templeton was a pastor. He was an evangelist. He was a colleague of Billy Graham's. Billy Graham said that Charles Templeton was more gifted than he was, and it led many people to Christ. But as Templeton saw more and more sorrow and pain in the world, his faith grew weaker and weaker. And one day he said, he was watching television and he saw this the satellite feed from Africa, and he saw this mother emaciated and dying from the drought that was there. She had not eaten. She had a baby in her arms. The baby was still attached to her dried up breast, and the baby had died. There was a dead baby in her arms, and she was dying. And as he looked at this complete, just utter depiction of sorrow and pain, he thought, God, all you had to do was send rain. And nobody else can send rain. You are the sender of rain. Why wouldn't you send rain? Why would you want this to happen? Why didn't you stop this? And at that point, he said he stopped believing in God. God had to either be this monster who enjoyed pain or just not existent at all. And that's something we all feel. We feel this, Lord, if you're there, if you're loving, if you're gracious, then why is there so much pain? And the problem of suffering basically just gets down to this question, why doesn't God do more to help? We're overwhelmed with the scope of suffering, how much we see in the world. We're overwhelmed with the inequality of it, the fact that some people seem to have it so good and others have it so bad. It seems to make it worse. In the movie As Good As It Gets, Jack Nicholson describes that. He said, they're these three friends, sort of, these people are thrown together. They're talking about how bad their childhoods were and different things that they suffered through. And the lady in the movie tries to comfort her friend by saying, well, everybody has it bad. And Jack Nicholson stops her and says, no, that's not true. Some people have good lives. Some people have good parents. And their childhood is filled with picnics and noodle salad. And other people are like us. And that's what bothers us so much. That's what makes us so angry, that we had all this suffering and other people had noodle salad. And that inequality, it gnaws at us. It's not an argument of logic. It's an argument of the heart. It's the kind of argument my grandmother had. My grandmother never went to church a day that I never knew her. Her name was Mama Shug. Her father named her Shug. Her mama named her Hattie, but nobody knew that. Her father named her Shug. And Shug's first daughter died in her arms at 2 weeks old from a fever. And Shug's oldest son died from electrocution when he was 16. And she never went to church. And my brother went to share the gospel with her after he was converted. He cared for her and he wanted her to believe, and he went and explained the gospel to her, and Shug looked at him and said, oh, I believe in Jesus. I'm just really mad at his father right now. And that's the kind of argument that drives us away. It's an argument of scope. It's an argument of the heart. It's not a logical syllogism. It's just a feeling of, why aren't you helping? As one of my friends puts it, he feels like God is a kindergartner with a magnifying glass, and he's just enjoying the feeling of frying ants. Why aren't you helping? You could help. And if you're not going to help, then I'm not going to believe. What good are you? It's a problem that is very familiar in the Bible. It's not a problem that the Bible turns an eye to, and I want you to know that. It's a problem the Bible looks at honestly. Some of the examples that we have of prayers in the Bible sound like this. Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. And by night, I find no rest. You ever feel that way? Do you feel like you're a bad Christian if you admit that you feel that way? God, I need this. I just need this little thing. It would be so easy for you. And you won't help. That's the stumbling block of pain. That's the problem of pain. And I want to talk to us about it. I want us to talk about it freely and honestly. And what I want, I can't present to you a clear, clarified argument. I can't make this pretty. We're going to drive this back into mystery, but I do want to tell you what the Bible says about it. And as we look at what the Bible says, I want you to find the hope that's there. The first thing I want you to see is the origin of suffering. About the problem of pain. This week I'm talking about suffering. I'm separating the two because I think it's a problem. Last week I talked about evil. Evil has a different origin than suffering. Evil is turning away from God. Mankind created evil. When we turned away from God, it's as if the light were behind us and we created this shadow, and evil is the shadow. Sin creates evil. It brings pain, and sin hates God. And since sin hates God, it oftentimes shows itself in the form of evil upon God's image. Whenever Satan or sin sees God's image, it hates it because it's reminded of God, and it wants to take out violence. It wants to take out pain on Him. That's the origin of evil. The origin of suffering is different. A lot of evil causes suffering, but there's some suffering that's not caused by evil. There's tsunamis, and there's droughts, and there's cancers, and there's all kinds of pain that has nothing to do with sin, but it still causes great suffering. I want you to see that the origin of suffering is from God Himself. He gave it to us, and I believe He gave it to us for a reason. But the first thing I want you to see is the origin of suffering. After Adam and Eve sinned, we're told this: to the woman God said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he will rule over you. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat of it, cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. God punishes humanity for sin by putting pain in our life. He put it there. He doesn't flinch from that. He said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing. That's a physical pain. That's the immense pain that came from the number of humans who have died in childbearing throughout the centuries. And it's the pain of child rearing, of raising up children in this broken world. I've been told many times, parents, you will only be as happy as your saddest child. Pain is just part of childbearing, child rearing. And it's different for humans than it is for animals. It's different because of this pain that God has multiplied into it. Have you ever noticed, have you ever watched an animal have children? They don't have children. Progeny? I watched my dog have puppies once in the kitchen floor. That's how we did it back in the redneck days. And it was just weird watching her because it was so non-dramatic, right? There's no crying, no screaming, no asking for an epidural, no getting other dogs behind her to help her push. I mean, she's just kind of laying there like, why are you looking at me? The look on her face was, why are you humans always staring at me? Like, this is nothing, nothing to see here, just having a few puppies. It's just different. And work, when you watch animals go feed, they're just kind of hopping around, you know, eating a little bit. But humans, they have to toil. They have to struggle. All the pain of feeding yourself and feeding your family, all the pain of raising food, of getting jobs, of dealing with unemployment, of dealing with underemployment, of worrying about bills, all of that pain is given to us by God for a reason. He put it there. He cursed the ground for us. He caused the ground to give thorns and thistles. And He has separated us from the tree of life so that we will die. All of that is the result of His judgment upon us. And now the question is, why would God do that? He could just be vindictive and mean, in which case we could maybe, and that's what some people believe, and that's why they worship. That's why the pagans would worship with sacrifices. They were trying to appease their God's anger and wrath. That's why the Islams pray so often, because they're trying to appease God and keep Him happy so that He won't punish them. But I don't think that's what the Bible tells us about God. I think the Christian Bible tells a different story, and that even His discipline has a purpose. And the Bible tells us that suffering has a purpose. And I want us to look at that. And the reason why I want us to look at that is this. The whole crux of this problem of pain, of this argument for suffering, is this. There is no way that God would give us pain. If He's a good God, He wouldn't do that. The whole argument hinges on this belief that there can be no good reason why God would give us suffering. And the Bible says there is a reason, and that it's important. And the Bible tells us more than that. It tells us who God is in suffering. And I want this argument not only to hit us logically, because ultimately, like I said, it's not a logical argument. It's an argument of the heart. And I don't want you to feel it. And the first thing I want you to see is that the pain has the purpose of weaning us away from the world. God puts pain in the world so we won't love it. There are things in this world that you just think, if you just had them, everything would be perfect. If I just were married, everything would be perfect. And so God makes our marriages fights. He makes them hard. Your desire will be for your husband. He's going to rule over you. He makes marriage difficult, so you won't be satisfied, so you'll look for something better. If we just had children, I would feel like my purpose in this life would be perfect, and I would be so happy. It's so fun to watch these young mothers when they're first pregnant for the first time, and they just think, it's going to be so wonderful. And it is wonderful, but it's hard. And it hurts. And your heart breaks. And it doesn't satisfy you, and it makes you want something better. And we want to find our identity in our jobs. And we want to find so much joy in doing this job. And so God puts pain in our toil so that we will look for something better. God is drawing us away from these things of the world and casting our eyes to Him so that we will look for something better. C.S. Lewis says, we're like children playing in the mud. And we keep getting offered this trip to the seaside, but because we haven't seen the seaside, we can't even imagine how good it would be. And so God gives us pain. And He gives us this overwhelming sense that things should not be this way. They should be better. So that we long for something better. God uses pain to wean us away from the world. God uses pain to make us call out to Him. The story throughout the Bible is of people who are forgetting God, and so they get into trouble, and when they're in trouble and oppressed, they call out to Him. Jacob saves his family, and they go into Egypt, and there they have plenty of food and water, and they forget about God, and the Egyptians take them into slavery, and the slavery becomes extremely oppressive, and they remember God, and they call out to him to save them, and he saves them, and he brings them into the promised land, and there's a generation of godly and righteous people, and their children are less righteous, and their children's children forget about God. So God brings in different nations to oppress them so they will call out to Him to be saved. And we see that in our lives. When the first testimony we had a couple of weeks ago, Jason didn't tell you a story about winning a national championship and going, God, He gave this to me. I mean, I've seen almost every Super Bowl. Everybody's got their own claim to fame. That's it. I have never once seen somebody get offered the Super Bowl MVP and say, there must be a God. That's never been the response. But I heard Jason a couple of weeks ago say, in prison I called out to God. I've heard a lot of people say, I've lost everything and called out to God. God uses pain to get our attention, to show us that nothing else is going to save us, and make us call out to Him. God uses pain to make us call out to others. This is not a very fun American kind of sermon, but you're not created to be independent. You're not created to be an individual. You will not be complete as an individual. And suffering makes us call out to others and ask for help. There's a great story in the Old Testament it's in the book of Ruth, about this woman named Naomi. And Naomi thought that the best thing for her and her husband thought the best thing to do would be to go off to a foreign land and look for food there and make their life there. And they made their life among strangers. And they took husbands for their children, they took daughters for their husbands, for their sons. Sorry. They took daughters for their sons. And then a famine came. And Naomi's sons died. And her husband died. And in the midst of that great pain, she realized she needed her community, and she went back home. And her community gathered around her. And it says they celebrated her return. Everyone spoke, Naomi has returned, and they gathered around her. And in that community, she found her salvation. In pain, we call out to others. I don't know if you've been to see the movie Inside Out yet. I can't remember a movie I felt this way about. Like, I want you to see it. I want you to see it twice. It is just more profound than anything I've ever seen. Honestly, it's the most profound movie I've ever seen. And I'm not kidding at all about that. And they demonstrate this so beautifully when this girl who has lived her whole life, her parents have raised her just the way every parent I know raises every child I know, to never know sorrow. And she finally experiences sadness. And in the midst of that sadness, she calls out for help. And her parents come around her. And in that sadness, she finds love. And she's made complete. God uses pain so that we will reach out to each other. And in that community, find life. And finally, God uses pain because sadness heals. This is a mystery. I really can't explain it. I'm just going to say it. Hebrews says this in chapter 2, verses 10. Verse 10 says this, talking about Jesus. It was fitting that He, for whom and by whom all things exist, okay? It is fitting for God, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. God perfected Jesus, God in the flesh, through suffering. Jesus was made perfect through suffering. And then notice this, in James chapter 1 we're told, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Jesus was perfected through sadness, through sorrow, through pain, and His people are perfected, made complete through sorrow and through pain. I don't understand the whys of that. I'm not sure that we're supposed to. I do know this. We live in a broken world. And the correct response to a broken world is sadness. And so if you don't know sadness, you're not lined up with this world. You're living in a fantasy land if you don't know sadness. And you're lined up with God, who is sorrowful for this world. And sadness is so powerful that it has its own healing properties. A counselor I know named John Cox practices in Jackson, Mississippi, and he was brought in to speak to the campus ministers, the RUF campus ministers, last week. And he told them this. He said, in my practice, if I can get a patient to sadness, over 50% of my job is done. If I can get them through anger, through anxiety, through denial, if I can just get them to be sad, my job is done. The healing has begun. There's this healing property. We're so afraid of it. And I have experienced that in my own limited experiences. A person after person, I don't have patience in any sense of the word. I have no patience. Person after person comes into my office, and I tell them, they'll tell me what's going on in their life, and I'll say, I'm sorry. And they'll go, no, don't be sorry. Why not? It sucks. Your life is broken. Why can't I be sorry? You should be sorry. You should be sad. No, I don't want to feel like I'm entitled to something. You are entitled. You're a human. You're the image of God. Your life should have been better. I'm sorry. Just be sad. That's where the healing begins. God gives us pain to bring us into line with the world, I think. I think it heals. Somehow we're made perfect through it. But that's not the end. God doesn't just give us pain. That would be a terrible Christmas present, now, wouldn't it? Hey, pain! Bye! But He meets us in our pain, and He meets us very physically in our pain. God brings an end to the suffering. He brings an end to the suffering through sending His servant. That servant, Jesus, read out Isaiah 61. This is the passage he read, the first sermon he preached in Nazareth. He said, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of God's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn." God has given us Jesus. He has come to us as Jesus. He has come to us to heal our pain. And He heals it. He brings He binds up our broken hearts. He comforts our mourning by suffering with and for us. He is the God who suffers with and for us. He suffers with us. He knows the pain of hunger. He knows the pain of sorrow. He knows the pain of loneliness. He knows the pain of anxiety. God Himself was made perfect through those pains. He knows the pain of betrayal, of torture, of shame, of being stripped naked and laughed at, to be killed. God Himself experienced that pain. And Him experiencing it makes Him different from every God that has ever been proclaimed on this earth. He is not a God who's somehow away from pain. He's not a God somehow who's immune to it. He is a God who suffers with and for us. John Stott, who I think wrote the best thing that's ever been written on the problem of pain, it's the last chapter of The Cross of Christ, and I commend it to you warmly. He uses these two illustrations. He talks first about a story written by a Brazilian, and it's called about the Christ of Corcovado. Corcovado is the mountain that overlooks Rio de Janeiro, and there's a 200-foot statue of Jesus on the top of that mountain looking down the city, and he's holding his arms out to bless the city, and I guess it's supposed to be inspiring, but it gives Jesus the appearance of being up, away, separate from all the real life. And he tells this story about a poor man who speaks to the statue. He climbs laboriously 2,310 feet up to the colossal statue, and he says, "Christ, I have climbed to you from the filthy, confined quarters down there to put before you these considerations. There are 900,000 of us down there in the slums of that city. And you, Christ, you remain here on your mountain, surrounded by divine glory. Go down there into the slums. Come with me into the slums and live with us down there. Don't stay away from us. Live among us. Give us new faith in you and in the Father. Come live with us. And that's the true heart of Christianity, that God made Himself poor. He gave up all of His riches, all of His privileges, all of His immunity to pain, to suffer evil, to suffer pain for us and with us. Stott summarizes by saying this, and I hate long quotes, but I'm going to read this slowly because I just can't say it any better than he did. He says, "I could never myself believe in God if it were not for the cross. The only God I believe in is God on the cross. In the real world of pain, how could we worship a God who is immune to it? I've entered many Buddhist temples in Asian countries, and I've stood respectfully before the statue of Buddha, his legs crossed, his arms folded, his eyes closed, the ghost of a smile playing around his mouth, a remote look on his face. He's detached from the agonies of the world. And each time I have to turn away. And in my imagination, I turn instead to that lonely, twisted, tortured figure on the cross. Nails through his hands and feet, back lacerated, limbs wrenched, brow bleeding from thorn pricks, mouth dry, intolerably thirsty, plunged into God-forsaken darkness. That is the God for me. He laid aside his immunity to pain. He entered our world of flesh and blood, tears and death. He suffered for us. Our sufferings become more manageable in the light of His. There's still a question mark against human suffering, but over it we boldly stamp another mark, the cross that symbolizes divine suffering. The cross of Christ is God's only self-justification in a world such as ours." That suffering makes our suffering tolerable, and it gives us sweet fellowship with God in the midst of it. He goes through it for us, with us. He understands us. That's what I wish so badly someone had known to say to Mama Shug. I wish someone in that southern town who could have gone and sat with her and said, "Mama Shug, I'm sorry you lost your daughter and your son. And I can't imagine how much that hurts. But God Himself knows how it feels to watch His son die. And He knows how you feel." There is an inexpressible comfort in that. It doesn't make sense to those who haven't felt it, but it makes sense to people who have gone through it. I've sat with a girl who had been abused sexually and watched her eyes just light up when she explained to me the importance that Jesus was crucified naked, that He knew her shame. I've read the story of Joni Erickson Tata, who was paralyzed as an 18-year-old and lived her life in a wheelchair with no use of her arms and legs. And as someone was trying to explain the gospel to her, someone was telling her how God understood, how Jesus understood her, and her response was the sarcastic, "Oh, really? Does Jesus know how it feels to not be able to move His arms and legs?" And God brought to her mind the cross. And she said, "Yes, Jesus does know how it feels to have your arms pinned and your legs pinned. He does know me." And at that moment, a light came on for her that never went out. I can't explain why there's so much suffering. And I know it's our job as the church to extinguish suffering. And that's why we are so active in doing that. That's why 90% of the non-governmental organizations, the charities throughout the world, are Christian organizations working to solve hunger and to solve pain. But I still don't know why there's so much. But I know this, God is there with it, with us in it. And He gives us hope through it. Please pray with me.